listeners and friends. You are listening to a reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, June 16th. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. Why don't we go ahead and take a look around at today's front page. The first headline on the Herald today says, Officials Weigh Vaccine Initiatives. Next story headline reads, Miraculous, in big letters and an exclamation point. And the last headline on the front page reads, Court Dismisses Mask Citations Against Seven Hills. We will start with Officials Weigh Vaccine Initiatives. Meanwhile, the vaccination site at Kennedy Mall could close at the end of June. This is filed by Benjamin Fisher of the Telegraph Herald. Dubuque County health officials are considering using federal COVID-19 relief dollars to encourage more people to get vaccinated against the disease, even as they look to potentially close their main vaccination site. Of the nearly $19 million Dubuque County is set to receive from the American Rescue Plan, more than $8 million is already in the coffers. Recent updates from the U.S. Department of the Treasury have inspired the County Board of Supervisors and members of the Dubuque County COVID-19 Incident Management Team to explore directing some of that money to vaccine-hesitant residents. We now know with some more clarity in the latest Treasury guidance that initiatives for vaccines can be included to continue to try and get more and more people vaccinated, Supervisor Ann McDonough said at a meeting this week. I'd ask for some creativity in pursuing all of our citizens to consider being vaccinated. County Health Department Executive Director Patrice Lambert was quick to agree with the idea. I can see where that would be very beneficial, she said. That could be something we could consider even for the booster, since we don't know if the Center for Disease Control and Prevention will be recommending boosters in the future for COVID. Lambert said the only reason that members of the incident management team had not put together such a proposal was because they thought they would have to ask the federal government for approval. Since that is not the case, the team will develop and present a plan to the county supervisors soon. However, she also said that the Iowa Department of Public Health has not considered the practice of providing incentives in recent discussions with the county health departments. McDonough said that should not stop Dubuque County. Our governor has said she is not going to support initiatives, so I'm not surprised that the DIPH is not going to pursue that, she said. We know our citizens better than the governor. I don't want that to chill us from doing what we need to get the job done. Lambert also told supervisors that the incident management team intends to let the county's lease of the former Yonkers Woman's Store at Kennedy Mall expire at the end of the month, though the decision has not been finalized. The site has served as the county's COVID-19 vaccine point of distribution since early February. However, the healthcare providers who have staffed the site so far have been packing up to go home, Lambert said. The only provider who will be working at the site after this week is the Visiting Nurse Association, which is contracted by the county. All of our vaccine providers are going to be pulling out completely from the site and working within their own agencies, basically because of the staffing issues that they have had in their offices, she said. And our lease does end at the end of June. The current lease also includes avenues for extension, however. Lambert said the current plan was for a sign to be erected at the Yonkers site informing any people who come after June 25th of the closure of the site and directing them to nearby pharmacies. The VNA also could operate as a site modeled after the Yonkers location out of its offices in Dubuque. The site has seen a reduction in walk-in and appointments in recent weeks, but there have been outliers. Last Friday, for instance, 191 people received shots at the site, half of whom were walk-ins. County Supervisor Jay Wickham said he was concerned about losing the site. If you're putting up a big sign to direct people to other places and you think it's effective, you might as well just give the vaccine to people reading the sign at the location, he said. The other private providers have the choice to serve the public however they want to, but the VNA, who are funded by Dubuque County and the Board of Health, should get direction from the Board of Health and the Board of Supervisors. Wickham asked Lambert to return with data showing the trend of vaccinations being administered at the site before any decision is finalized. County Emergency Management Director Tom Berger said one other reason to potentially let the lease expire is problems providers are facing with air conditioning at the site. Of the units that they have, there are only two working, he said. So even though the thermostat is set on 68, it only goes down to 72 or 73 in there. I don't think we want to replace the air conditioner, but it's rather warm in there for people who are working there. On to our next article. It's entitled Miraculous! All-Inclusive Miracle League Field is a hit with players. This is filed by Eric Hogstrom of the Telegraph Herald. Mackenzie McDonald swung and connected, sending the ball deep into the outfield. She smiled broadly as she reached first, then advanced to second, then third, and eventually reached home. It is fun. It's a good opportunity because even special needs people can play, said McDonald, 31, a resident of a group home operated by Hills and Dales in Dubuque. McDonald, some of her housemates, and a group of local children took turns hitting the ball and running the bases Tuesday at the Miracle League of Dubuque Field, an all-inclusive ballpark at Veterans Memorial Park, designed and staffed to accommodate all levels of abilities. That's exactly what this whole thing is about, said Tom Wrighty, a retired Hampstead High School baseball coach and one of the organizers for the $4.5 million Miracle League of Dubuque project, which includes the baseball field and an all-inclusive playground with equipment that includes chair-like swings and a zip line. Dubuque Leisure Services and Miracle League volunteers are hosting free pep and play camps at the field from 10 a.m. to noon Tuesdays and Thursdays this summer. It's amazing. We've waited almost 2 years to get people on the field, said Jana Bowe, program supervisor for the local Miracle League. Our hope is to have the Tuesday and Thursday events be a training and conditioning camp. We want to get all levels and ages to come out and play. On Tuesday, some kids whacked softballs off a tee. Others swung and struck pitches lobbed to them by a Miracle League volunteer who always happens to be an Iowa High School Baseball Coach Association Hall of Famer member, retired Wallert Catholic High School coach Ed Frayne. When Tom Whitery asked me to help, I couldn't turn this down, Frayne said. Trey Tallow, 7, of Dubuque, sprayed the line drives across the park Tuesday. It was fun, Trey said. I like it because you can get home runs if you hit it hard enough. Sophia Leahy, 10, of Sherrill, Iowa, took a brief water break after she pounded the ball and raced around the bases a few times. This field is nice, Sophia said. Playing on it is fun because it gets you working out. Bo said the field welcomes and encourages players of all abilities. It is technically everyone's field, she said. Everyone can come and play. The field also will be staffed 4 evenings per week this month and 5 nights per week starting in July. It is supervised, and we have sanitized equipment here, Bo said. Everyone can come and play. Whitery said he expects teams to form for all-inclusive league play by this fall. He is seeking volunteers to act as field angels who can help players of all differing abilities successfully swing the bat and run the bases as needed. Each player will bat twice, there will be no outs, and the other team will come in to bat after each half inning, Whitery said, of league play. On Tuesday, McDonald cheered from the dugout bench as one of her housemates, Brooke Sheff, stole second base and other players continued to bash the balls past Whitery into the outfield. another of McDonald's housemates, Becky Kleinfelter, took off for home from third base after a player's hard-hit smash into the outfield. "It's nice having younger kids and special needs play together," McDonald said. "Even if it's different age groups, it's cool." Our third article from the Telegraph Herald and the last article on the front page reads, "Court dismisses mask citations against Seven Hills. Assistant city attorney says legislation signed into law in May limited oversight by local governments." The story was filed by Jeff Montgomery of the Telegraph Herald. Four municipal citations issued against a Dubuque brewery and its owner related to violations of the city's mask mandate recently were dismissed. An Iowa District Court magistrate granted the City of Dubuque's request to dismiss three infractions against Seven Hills Brewing Company and one against its owner, Keith Gutierrez. The citations were issued in late 2020 after the business refused to enforce a city mask mandate, which was instituted in hopes of slowing the spread of COVID-19. Specifically, the citations were issued for failure to post face covering requirements and for not requiring employees to wear face coverings. The initial citation against Seven Hills carried a maximum fine of $750, while the two subsequent ones had a maximum of $1,000. The violation for Gutierrez could have been as high as $750. News of the citation's dismissal shocked Gutierrez, who said he expected to lose the case in district court and then file an appeal. "My end goal was to bring it to the Supreme Court of Iowa," he said Tuesday. Gutierrez contested that the city was overstepping its boundaries by enforcing a mask mandate at the time when the state had not issued one. In its request for dismissal, the City of Dubuque cited legislation passed by state lawmakers, then signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds on May 20th, that limited school district and local government's ability to impose mask mandates. Maureen Kwan, assistant city attorney for the City of Dubuque, acknowledged that the governor's actions wasn't retroactive, meaning it did not prevent the city from enforcing mask mandate violations from 2020. However, the action did prove further evidence that the landscape around COVID-19 had changed. The legal climate had greatly evolved at the state and local levels in regards to mask mandates, Kwan explained. In addition to that, the best tools to slow the spread of COVID-19 had changed greatly as vaccinations had become readily available. At the time that both Dubuque and Dubuque County officials issued mask mandates last year, Reynolds and the State Attorney General's office contended that local governments did not have that authority. Gutierrez, in November, said that he was standing up against tyranny by opposing the city's mask mandate. However, enforcement of the mandate was sparse. Kwan said the city issued seven citations over the course of the pandemic, including at least four tied to Seven Hills. Three other individuals that received citations opted to pay them right away. Kwan said associated fines are similar to the cost of a parking ticket. The penalties for the Seven Hills citation only rose to $750 or higher once it became a municipal citation and entered the court system. "With both businesses and individuals, our goal was providing education and information rather than issuing a fine," Kwan said. The brewery's stand on the mask mandate drew a spirited response on social media, with many leveling criticism at Seven Hills. Gutierrez said it was never his intent to be controversial. "Some of my best friends didn't agree with my decision," he said. "There were a few employees who were very angry at what I did and ended up leaving." However, Gutierrez said the majority of his employees, as well as many customers, were appreciative of the stance the brewery took. "At the same time, I felt it was the right thing to do," he said. "I still feel like it was the right thing to do." The order from the Iowa District Court stated that the City of Dubuque must pay costs related to the court proceedings. Kwan explained that the city paid $95 for each citation at the time of their filing, and as the losing party in the case will not recoup these funds. All right, moving on over to some more local news. This next headline reads, "Local teens send dresses to Africa." This was filed by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald. Maquoketa, Iowa. Two Maquoketa high school students spent the final weeks of the school year turning pillowcases into dresses for kids in need. Taylan Baker, 16, of Zwingle, and Kayla DeSoyo, 18, of Maquoketa, sewed pillowcase dresses for Little Dresses for Africa as part of a service project in their Dynamics of Clothing class. "I just enjoyed making them, and I thought it was a good project for people in need," Taylan said. Little Dresses for Africa is an international organization that donates clothing to children in need in African countries. The organization also works to bring clean water, schools, and community structures such as feeding centers to areas where they are needed. "I've always wanted to do a service project in class, and somehow we always run out of time," said Maquoketa High School family consumer science teacher Nancy Johnson. "This year, I set up the last 4 to 5 weeks to work on the project." Johnson pitched several potential projects, but Little Dresses for Africa was most exciting to the girls. They followed a pattern on the organization's website to make the dresses using pillowcases, elastic, and bias tape, a narrow fabric strip used for binding. In the month spent on the project, Taylan completed 20 dresses. She worked during Johnson's class, came in during study period to sew, and took dresses home to finish them. "I'm so impressed," Johnson said. "She just took hold of it and went with it and was just so focused on getting dresses sewn and finished." Kayla attended school remotely but came in several days a week to work on dresses. Because she was in the classroom less frequently than Taylan, and because she said she's a perfectionist when it comes to making things, especially clothing, she completed only 2 dresses. However, she still enjoyed the experience and the chance to give back. "Here in America, we have so many opportunities, and we can easily get a job or water or clothes, and over there, it's not as easy as we have it here. So I think that's what made me passionate about it," she said. After the school year ended, Johnson mailed the dresses to Little Dresses for Africa's U.S. headquarters in Michigan. From there, they will be delivered to African communities. Kayla, who graduated this spring, will study business at Clinton Community College and plans to transfer to Il Salto Margoni in Florida to study fashion styling. Taylan will complete her senior year of high school and hopes to pursue a career in nursing. Her class schedule will dictate whether she can continue with Little Dresses for Africa next year, but she hopes to stay involved. "I'll probably will do some dresses because it's fun and relaxing to do," she said. "It's just an easy project to do for something that makes a big impact." Next, another Dubuque story. The headline reads, "Dubuque Casino President, CEO to retire, Board selects successor." Alex Dixon will fill the role to be vacated by longtime leader Jesus Alves in late summer. This was filed by Jeff Montgomery of the Telegraph Herald. The longtime president and CEO of Q Casino and Hotel in Dubuque will step down by the end of the year. Meanwhile, the board of directors of the Dubuque Racing Association on Tuesday selected an experienced gaming executive to succeed him. Casino president and CEO Jesus Alves confirmed Tuesday that he plans to retire prior to the end of 2021, ending a lengthy run with the casino. "We're very sad to know that he is leaving," said DRA board chairman Kevin Lynch. I think everyone could agree Jesus has had a stellar career over his 14 years here and his 54 career in the gaming industry in total. The board of the DRA, which serves as the nonprofit license holder for both Dubuque casinos, unanimously authorized an employment agreement with Alex Dixon, who emerged as the leading candidate after an exhaustive search. Lynch said the casino already had a verbal agreement in place with Dixon and now will finalize the contractual language. Dixon, a Nevada native, will relocate to Dubuque in August and shift into Alves' role soon thereafter. He currently is the West Region President at Pure Star, a commercial laundry company that counts multiple Las Vegas hospitality businesses among its clients. Dixon also has spent 11 years as a gaming executive, holding various leadership roles for MGM and Caesars Entertainment in the markets across the U.S. Lynch and Dixon would earn an annual base salary of $450,000 per year, with a 35% bonus in his first year on the job. In subsequent years, this bonus would be performance-based. Dixon's compensation will be comparable to what was paid to Alves, Lynch said. Dixon said Dubuque wasn't on his radar until a recruitment firm contacted him about the job at Q Casino. He visited the city with his wife about a month ago, and the couple fell in love with the community. "We were quite frankly blown away," he said. "From the outside looking in, it seems like a great place to raise a family." Dixon and his wife have three kids, including one who is nonverbal autistic, Dixon said. He believes local schools and organizations such as Hills and Dales will offer an important support system for his family. Looking forward, Dixon believes Q Casino has vast potential to further establish itself as a multifaceted destination that augments its gaming amenities with everything from dining to live entertainment. He said finding new users for underutilized properties on Chaplin Schmidt Island could open new opportunities. "I think there's an appetite from the board and hopefully from the community and the city to fully leverage and unleash the full potential of the casino," Dixon said. Alves stepped into the role at Q Casino, then known as Dubuque Greyhound Park and Casino, at the time when its crosstown competitor Diamond Joe Casino was preparing to build a new facility, a development many thought could doom Q Casino. Under his leadership, Q Casino constructed major facility improvements, broke ranks with the Greyhound industry, purchased the Hilton Garden Inn Hotel, and ramped up entertainment offerings. "I have been in the industry 45 years, Alves said. "That's a long time, and I felt like the timing was right to retire. It's been a good run." Here are some news briefs from the area. Police man assaulted, burned girlfriend with cigarette, threatened her with knife. Police said a Dubuque man choked and punched his then-girlfriend, burned her with a cigarette, and threatened her with a knife. Anthony G. Brethren, 53, of 305 West 16th Street, number 2, was arrested at 1:04 p.m. Monday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on warrants charging false imprisonment, domestic assault while displaying a weapon, domestic assault with strangulation, domestic assault with injury, 2 counts of stalking, and 2 counts of first-degree harassment. Court documents made available Tuesday state that Lynn Janeman, 41, of 2160 Elm Street, number 210, contacted police on March 27, 2020, to report that Brethren had assaulted her during the course of the past month. Janeman told police that the assaults took place at 2 different residences in Dubuque, including a choking incident and Brethren threatening her while holding a knife, and said that she was held against her own will and was constantly being assaulted if she attempted to leave, documents state. The abuse occurred every day, Janeman told the police, and included Brethren punching her in the face and head, stomping her in the ribs and holding her to the floor by her hair, documents state. Gentleman's injuries included bruising to her legs, scratches around her left ear, and a cigarette burn on her left hand. Documents state that in May 2020, Brethren made enormous threats against Gentleman while leaving a series of voicemail messages on her phone. Next news brief. American Red Cross seeks blood donors during severe shortage. A rising number of trauma cases, organ transplants, and elective surgeries has created a severe blood shortage, according to the American Red Cross. A press release from the organization states that the Red Cross has distributed about 50,000 more blood products than expected during the past 3 months. Blood is perishable and cannot be stockpiled, so it must be continuously replenished by donors. Appointments to donate blood can be made via Red Cross Blood Donor app or by calling 1-800-733-2767 or by enabling the blood donor skill on an Alexa Echo device, according to the release. Donors who give blood now through June 30th will receive a $5 Amazon gift card via email. You are listening to a reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, June 16th. Now let's turn over to the obituaries. Betty J. Phillips. Betty J. Phillips, 88, of Dubuque, passed away Monday, June 7th, 2021 at Stonehill Care Center. Services will be held on June 28th at 10 a.m. at St. Lakes Methodist Church. A celebration of life will be held on June 29th at the Franny Stout House from 4 to 6 p.m. This is in lieu of a visitation. Arrangements entrusted to Inhofe Streit Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road, Dubuque. Betty was born on July 20, 1932, in Blanchard, Iowa, the daughter of Templeton and Elizabeth Rice. She married Carl L. Phillips on June 24, 1956. He preceded her in death on April 25, 2004. Betty graduated with her B.S. in nursing from University of Iowa in 1955. She went on to earn an M.A. in counseling and guidance from Loras College in 1976 and completed doctoral coursework in education at Iowa State University. She was employed by the NICC in Potosa as a placement and financial aid officer for 22 years and as part-time instructor in the business and communication department. She was an instructor at Findlay Hospital School of Nursing and associate director. She worked as a part-time staff nurse at Findlay Hospital and Hazel Green Hospital for several years. She was an instructor and clinical supervisor at St. Luke's Hospital School of Nursing in Cedar Falls. She began her career as a staff nurse at Rolph Memorial Clinic in Waverly, Iowa, and the University of Iowa Hospitals. Betty was active in professional organizations, including Women in Management as chapter president, National Vice President and President, Women's Leadership Network, Iowa Community College Student Services Association as president, Iowa Association of Financial Aid Administrators, Dubuque Community Schools to Work Committee, and Community and Schools Together. Betty was also listed in Who's Who in Education. She was involved with many civic organizations. She served on the board of directors for Hospice of Dubuque and American Cancer Society. She worked with Friendship Force and the Sisters City Commission. She was a member of St. Luke Methodist Church for over 50 years. At St. Luke's, she served on a variety of different committees and a historian and activist. She was a member of PEO, Beta Sigma Phi Sorority, American Legion Auxiliary, and Order of the Eastern Star. Betty enjoyed reading, cooking, eating, and dining, and drinking wine on the patio with her friends. She liked traveling in the U.S. and Europe. The family requests no flowers, memorials may be made to St. Luke's United Methodist Church, Tiffany Widows Fund. 1199 Main Street, Dubuque, Iowa 52001. Nursing scholarships at the University of Iowa Foundation, Dubuque County Humane Society. Edwin A. Whitfield, Overland Park, Kansas. Dr. Edwin Ed Whitfield, 83, of Overland Park, Kansas, died on June 3, 2021, at KC Hospice House. Ed was born to Edwin Allen and Matilda Whitfield on November 10, 1937, in Dubuque, Iowa. Throughout his life, he returned to Dubuque, a place he loved, to enjoy the city, the Mississippi River, and the family he treasured. Ed graduated from Loras Academy in Dubuque. He received a BA degree from Loras College, an MD from Ohio University at Athens, and a PhD from the University of Iowa. Ed began his long and beloved career in guidance and counseling with the San Diego Department of Education. His passion of research, writing, and editing resulted in his being sought to consult and lead in his chosen field on the state and national level. His publications and leadership positions were numerous that included former and first editor of the California Personnel and Guidance Journal. In 1984, his career took him to Columbus, Ohio, where he served education as an associate director with the State of Ohio Department of Education. He was elected president of the National Career Development Association, served the Ohio University Alumni Association, and was president of the Ohio Cancer Development Association. Even after his retirement, he volunteered to serve and lead publications in his chosen academic field. While reading, learning, and writing were his passion, Ed still found time to enjoy gardening, golfing, fishing, and sharing his quiet wit and dry humor with friends and family. A private memorial will be held at a future date in Dubuque, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be sent to Ed's favorite charity, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, 501 St. Jude Place, Memphis, Tennessee, 38105, or to the Patton College of Education Scholarship Endowment, Ohio University, P.O. Box 869, Athens, Ohio, 45701. Geraldine A. Millard, Mineral Point, Wisconsin. Geraldine Ann Millard of Mineral Point, formerly of Finnamore, earned her wings after more than 88 years of trials, tribulations, and laughter in the temporal realm. Known as Dee Dee among her Mineral Point friends and family, and Jerry among those in Livingston and Finnamore, she died Saturday, June 12, 2021, surrounded by her closest family members, wishing her Godspeed en route to her divine destination. She was born October 25, 1932. Ever the mischievous, happy-go-lucky Irish lass, Geraldine loved telling cute little stories, particularly ones that involved a randy tomcat. She'll take such delight in sharing the story if you are fortunate enough to come across paths in heaven. She loved meeting new people and querying them about their hometowns or travel plans. She never possessed a materialistic bone in her body, but clung to nickels and dimes tighter than the bark on trees. Geraldine's most cherished currency was her golden devotion to family and the Roman Catholic Church. Until her health failed in 2017, she was an active member of St. Mary's Finnamore. Geraldine was a longtime employee of Rayovac. Geraldine devoted her to her faith was a natural extension of her upbringing. Geraldine had seven McNitty uncles and aunts who were called to serve in parishes and parochial schools throughout Wisconsin. Her grandfather's brother, Father Eugene and Daniel McNaughty, worked with the Venerable Father Samuel Mazzaculli to establish the six Roman Catholic churches churches in Wisconsin, including Holy Rosary Catholic Church in Darlington. Geraldine grew up worshiping at St. Patrick's, Hollandale, where her father's brother, Father James McNitty, was parish priest. In addition to her sons, she is survived by 4 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. A funeral mass will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, June 18, 2021, at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Finnamore, with burial to follow at Rock Church Cemetery, rural Livingston. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at the Larson Family Funeral Home in Finnamore on Friday morning. Mary C. Link, Holy Cross, Iowa. Mary C. K. Link, 94, of Holy Cross, passed away Monday, June 14, 2021, at Mercy Medical Center in Dubuque, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 17, 2021, at Kramer Funeral Home in Holy Cross. Visitation will continue Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. at the funeral home prior to funeral services. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, June 18, 2021, at Holy Cross Catholic Church in Holy Cross. Reverend Dennis Quint will officiate. Burial will be in Holy Cross Cemetery. Kay was born July 29, 1926, in Rickardsville, Iowa, the daughter of Harold and Grace Hannon. She married Leon Link on April 27, 1948, in Rickardsville, Iowa. Together, they farmed in the Balltown area until 1969, when they moved to Holy Cross. After she raised her children, Kay worked for the Western Dubuque School District in the Holy Cross Kindergarten. The students and co-workers were all special to her. She liked sewing, cooking, and baking, and her family and grandchildren were the apple of her eye. Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville is assisting the family, and information is available. Online condolences and memorials may be sent to Kramer Funeral Home, 705 12th Avenue, Southwest, Dyersville, Iowa, 52040. Jeremy Weist, Lancaster, Wisconsin. Jeremy L. Weist, age 38, of Lancaster, Wisconsin, passed away on Monday, March 2, 2020, surrounded by his loving family, from an extremely rare form of Parkinson's disease known as HDLS. He was born April 22, 1981, in Lancaster, the son of Daniel and Linda Weist. Jeremy graduated from Lancaster High School in 2000. He worked for over 13 years at Lathkes Cheese Factory in Belmont, and as of most recently was employed at Hormel in Dubuque, Iowa. Jeremy was a fan of the Dallas Cowboys, Chicago Bulls, and NASCAR. He enjoyed bowling and playing video games. Surviving is his loving parents, Daniel and Linda, his sisters, Kelly, Darcy, Lacey, and Tiana, his brother, Tyler, 2 nieces, his parental grandmother, Rosemary Weist, and his aunts, uncles, and cousins. Jeremy is preceded in death by his maternal grandparents, Edmund and Alavany Sedbrook, his parental grandfather, Maurice Weist, a family members, Catherine Killenhofer, Gary Pagel, Joan Krantz, Edward Hall, Beverly Geisler, and the precious Celine babies. A celebration of Jeremy's life will be held on Saturday, June 19th, 2021, at the Erickson School Building at the Grant County Fairgrounds, Lancaster, Wisconsin, from noon to 3 p.m. A private family burial will be held at a later date. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory of Lancaster is assisting the family. Okay, why don't we turn over to the opinion section? First up is the Our View section. The headline reads, Celebrate Juneteenth, Community Multiculturalism. This weekend in Dubuque and around the country, Marking 156 years since the end of slavery, it's an important event to commemorate for numerous reasons. The Emancipation Proclamation was issued by President Abraham Lincoln on January 1, 1863, officially ending slavery in states still rebelling against the Union. But enforcing the new law relied on the advancement of Union troops, and word did not reach the enslaved people of Galveston, Texas until almost 2.5 years later. On June 19, 1865, by then, nearly 250,000 enslaved black people were working in Texas. Slavery was still legal in practice in Delaware and Kentucky until the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified later that year. June 19th, or Juneteenth, became the symbolic end of the era of slavery, and today is marked as a national holiday in most states. This year, in Dubuque, marks the 11th annual Juneteenth, presented by Multicultural Family Center, though similar celebrations had gone on for at least a decade prior. It's widely considered nationally to be the longest-running African-American holiday. The occasion provides not just a celebratory atmosphere of music, games, and great food, though there's that too, but an opportunity to raise cultural awareness and educate communities about the importance of the day. That's particularly important in such places as Dubuque, where people of color have not always felt welcomed and represent a fraction of the population. African Americans living in Dubuque want the same things as most people want in a hometown: quality education availability, employment opportunities, affordable housing, and public safety. For Dubuque to continue to grow and remain competitive and relevant in a changing economy means to embrace today's world and all the diversity that represents. It will require engaging with more people, learning to work together, and overcoming cultural barriers, understanding our neighbors and the history that has made them who they are today will go a long way toward building better community relations. This week, we celebrate Juneteenth as America's second Independence Day, the one that extended freedom to all Americans. We remember the scourge of slavery so many endured and vow to keep working toward becoming the land of equal opportunity. Editorials reflected the consensus of the Telegraph Herald editorial board. Our next Other View headline reads, Israel disregards internationally established rules of peace. This was penned by Frank Belicastro, North Grandview, Dubuque, Iowa. I read articles recently where far-right columnists defend Israel and blame Palestine for the latest insurrections. What they have omitted in their criticism is important. What started the last war is Israel closing Kerem Shalom Crossing on May 10th, blocking the entrance of humanitarian aid, vaccines, and fuels destined for Gaza's power plant, and on May 12th, banning all access to Gaza's sea space. No wonder Palestine retaliated. Israel is not experiencing the right to defend itself by employing its military machine against an occupied population that does not have mechanized units, an air force, navy missiles, heavy artillery, and command control. It's carrying out mass murder. It is a war crime. Hamas missiles lack accurate guidance system, which kill practically no one, while Israeli bombs are highly accurate and kill many. Not a contest. Does anyone know that Israel is in violation of UN General Assembly Resolution 194 that states that Palestinian refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be permitted to do so at the earliest possible date? This is annexation of East Jerusalem and the Syrian Golan Heights violations international law, as does its building of security barrier in the West Bank that annexes Palestinians' land into Israel. That is in violation of Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention for settling over 500,000 Jewish Israelis on occupied Palestinian land, and for the ethnic cleansing of at least 750,000 Palestinians when the Israeli state was founded, and another 300,000 after Gaza, East Jerusalem, and West Bank were occupied following the 1967 war. That is in breach of Article 3.3 of the Fourth Geneva Convention that defines the collective punishment of a civilization population as a war crime. That Israel is in breach of more than 30 UN Security Council resolutions. That does not sound like a peaceful country. Human Rights Watch, HRW, released a landmark report accusing Israel of apartheid crimes against humanity in its conduct toward Palestinians. These apartheid programs include mass land confiscation, the creation of separate population enclaves, unlawful home demolitions, the denial of residency rights, and the suspension of civil rights, among others. Amnesty International has uncovered Israel's monopoly on water in the occupied West Bank. The International Human Rights Organization has accused Israel of denying Palestinians the right to adequate water access. Israel uses over 80% of the mountain aquifer, the only quality water source for the populations in the West Bank. Though Israel has various other sources of water, it also uses the mountain aquifer and restricts access to it, leaving Palestinians to struggle with less than enough water. In contrast, Israeli settlers who live in the West Bank in violation of international law have intensive irrigation farms, lush gardens, and swimming pools. Israeli military contracts special Jewish-only roads in the West Bank, linking illegal Israeli settlements, which means Palestinians have to travel twice as far to reach a destination, which results in no continuity. Most importantly, in 2002, the Arab League has offered to recognize Israel and safeguard its borders if it will withdraw its troops to the 1967 border. Israel has refused this peace offer. These are not the acts of a civilized nation, but of a terrorist nation who's long ago lost its moral and ethical compass. It is now time to support the peaceful Palestinian boycott, disinvestment, sanctions movement. Blancastro taught on the secondary and college level for more than 50 years. He is a member of the World Beyond War, an anti-war organization. All right, why don't we flip over to some sports news? Our first sports headline is about Major League Baseball. MLB threatens pitchers with 10-game suspensions. Baseball cracks down on use of foreign substances. This was filed by Ronald Blum of the Associated Press. Dateline, New York. Pitchers will be ejected and suspended for 10 games for using illegal foreign substances to doctor baseballs in a crackdown by Major League Baseball that will start Monday. The commissioner's office, responding to record strikeouts and a league batting average that more than half a century low, said Tuesday that major and minor league umpires will start regular checks of all pitchers, even if opposing managers don't request inspections. While suspensions would be with pay, repeat offenses would receive progressive discipline, and teams and club employees would be subject to discipline for failure to comply. After an extensive process of repeated warnings without effect, gathering information from current and former players and others across the sport, 2 months of comprehensive data collection, listening to our fans, and throughout deliberation, I have determined that new enforcement of foreign substances is needed to level the playing field, Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred said in a statement. I understand there's a history of foreign substances being used on the ball, but what we are seeing today is objectively far different, with much trickier substances being used more frequently than ever before. It has become clear that the use of foreign substances has generally morphed from trying to get a better grip on the ball into something else, an unfair competitive advantage that is creating a lack of action and uneven playing field. The last pitchers suspended for using foreign substances were Baltimore's Brian Mautsitz and Milwaukee's Will Smith for 8 games, each in May 2015. Both appealed, and Smith's penalty was cut to 6 games, while Mautsitz's ban was upheld. The perception of an increased use of foreign substances tied to a drop in offense is viewed as the largest instance of widespread cheating in baseball since the rise of steroids, which ended in the adoption of random drug testing with penalties ahead of the 2004 season. Yankees ace Gerrit Cole, singled out by Minnesota's Josh Donaldson for a drop in spin rate in the June 3rd start, dodged a question last week about whether he had ever used a spider tack, a sticky substance designed for use by Strongham's competitors. "I don't quite know how to answer that, to be honest," Cole said. "There are customs and practices that have been passed down from older players to younger players, from the last generation of players to this generation of players. And I think there are some things that are certainly out of bounds in that regard." MLB told teams on March 23rd it would increase monitoring and initiated steps that included collecting balls taken out of play from every game and analyzing StatCast spin rate data. "Based on the information collected over the first 2 months of the season, including numerous complaints from the position players, pitchers, umpires, coaches, and executives, there is a perceivance of foreign substances use by pitchers in Major League Baseball and throughout the minor leagues, MLB said. "Many baseballs collected have had dark, amber-colored markings that are sticky to the touch. MLB recently completed extensive testing, including testing by third-party researchers, to determine whether the use of foreign substances had a material impact on performance. That research concluded that a foreign substance significantly increased the spin rate and movement of the baseball, providing pitchers who use this substance with an unfair competitive advantage over hitters and pitchers who do not use foreign substances, and results in less action on the field. In addition, the foreign substance use appears to contribute to a style of pitching in which pitchers sacrifice location in favor of spin and velocity, particularly with respect to elevated fastballs. The evidence does not suggest a correlation between improved hitter safety and the use of foreign substances. The anticipated clampdown ahead already appears to have had an impact. Fastball spin rates averaged 2,306 to 2,329 revolutions per minute each week from the start of the season through June 5th, according to MLB StatCast data. Following an owners' meeting on June 3rd, when talk of a crackdown emerged, the average declined to 2,282 during the week of June 6th and dropped to 2,222 on Sunday. The Major League batting average was .232 through April, down from 2.52 2 years ago and under the record low of 2.37 set in 1968, and it was 2.36 throughout May, its lowest since 1968. The average rose to .247 in the week of June 6, lifting the season average to .238. The strikeout percentage since June 3rd is 23.4% down from 24.2% until then, and the walk percentage is 8.4% down from 8.9%. This is not about any individual player or club or placing blame, Manfred said. It's about a collective shift that has changed the game and needs to be addressed. We have a responsibility to our fans and the general talent competing on the field to eliminate these substances and improve the game. All right, friends and listeners, that does it for today. You have been listening to a reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, June 16th. I've been your reader, Maddie Ryan. You can catch a recording of today's reading on the IRIS website at iowaradioreading.com. Have a great day, and as always, thank you so much for listening.